Welcome to the Rogue Startups Podcast, where two startup founders are sharing lessons learned and pitfalls to avoid in their online businesses. And now, here's Dave and Craig.
All right, welcome to Rogue Startups, episode 169. Mr. Craig, how are you this week?
Man, I'm great. I'm great. Hitting episode 169, it occurs to me we'll hit 200 before the end of the year, which is crazy. I guess right around the end of the year, which is crazy, Dave, to think that we'll have 200 podcast episodes. We're not quite up there with some of those guys that have been doing it for, 10 years, but this is 4 years we've been doing it, I guess, which is pretty crazy, man.
Yeah, I know. I can't really believe that either. I mean, Heaton and Steli are on a tear. They're on what, like episode 400 or something ridiculous like
right,
that, or maybe
2 weeks. So it's not fair. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they're doubling down and they're just crazy, but, I'm happy with where we're at. 169. That's a long time. It's a lot of episodes. That's a lot of talking.
That's a lot of talking. Yep.
There's a lot of bullshit that we've slung there along the way too.
I mean, stuff like the example we had of somebody like creating a business from a topic we talked about on the podcast recently, stuff like that is totally awesome. And like the stuff that keeps us coming back every week to record an episode and come up with stuff that hopefully is helpful for folks. So yeah, it's really good. So everyone out there who's been just sitting on their ass, get off of it and send us a comment or an email or a criticism or something to let us know that you're alive and involved. And we'll keep putting out good stuff.
And speaking of comments this week, we actually got a voicemail from Rob Walling himself talking about some of the things that we were discussing in the last episode.
Hey, gents, this is Rob Walling of MicroConf. Startups to the rest of us, various other sundry things. I appreciated hearing your conversation about MicroConf 2019 a couple episodes ago. It's always cool. I'm in the hallway track listening to folks' feedback and we get the surveys and stuff, but it's always cool to hear other people talking about it on their podcast because you kind of get, an inside view of it. There were two things that you mentioned that I wanted to kind of comment on, perhaps clarify or just add additional thoughts. One was something Dave said. He said he had been in conversation with Einar Volset, who's my, co-founder with Tiny Seed. And I believe they were at a dinner and he was, David said that there were some type of range that we're looking for our bottom end companies of like 3K or 5K MRR. And that's not accurate. And I'm guessing it was maybe a misunderstanding. And he may have said something like, most of the companies that have made it to the end or that we're making offers on are in a specific range or whatever, but that's not necessarily what we are looking for. Like to be honest, we didn't know what we were looking for when we posted the applications. I mean, I have a whole list of criteria, so we know what we're trying to get down to, but it wasn't like we said, well, if we don't find 12 companies with X MRR, then we're not going to take that many companies. That was not part of the conversation. It really was, let's see what the 10 or 12 best companies are that we can find, and hopefully they meet, at least a minimum bar in our heads of a company that can get this done, right, and can grow into the 7 or 8 figures. So there just isn't a range, right? I don't want people to, because people have asked us, like, what's your MRR range? And it's like, MRR is one factor. And I literally, again, I have a 2-page doc with probably 45, 50, 60 different signals and factors and all this stuff. And MRR is one of those, but it's not this end all be all thing, and it's kind of like trying to game the Google algorithm. Well, what one thing should I do? And it's like, there's not one thing. You have to do a lot. You have to show traction. You have to have founders who are getting stuff done. You have to have an idea in a market where it can actually grow into 7 or 8 figures. You have to have, on and on and on and on. In any case, I just wanted to throw that in so that I don't want people to think of this as some type of, a single number or there's, you can't apply to Tiny Seed if you're outside of this range or they only take within this range, because it's just not. It's not what's happening. So anyways, I'm pretty sure, that was probably a miscommunication or misunderstanding or whatever. The second thing that I thought was interesting, and it's something I've heard before, I don't recall who said it, but it was about my talk. And I believe one of you said that, someone said, wow, Rob's turned to the dark side because he's talking about funding, and that funding is a viable option or whatever. And it's such a trip to me because I've been talking about this stuff for a really long time, for 14 years. And I've heard the phrase, I've turned to the dark side, sold out, whatever you want to call it, dozens of times. You know, in 2008, when I started talking about split testing, I heard that's what internet marketers do. That's tricking people. And now we all split test because it's a best practice. And when I started talking about email marketing in 2009, someone said, yeah, several people, well, you're just a spammer if you're doing email. Why are you trying to collect my email address? I guess I turned to the dark side then too, right? And talking about SEO, people say that's gaming. It's, you know, it's dishonest. It's this and that. And I think most of us realize that's not true. Like this binary view of these things is not true. And they can be wielded with grace and with ethics and with a moral compass. And then they can be abused and black hatted, and almost anything can be taken to an extreme, to where it's not good. When I started talking about potentially raising an angel investment for Drip, where we were underwater and I needed, $500,000 to grow it faster, someone said the same thing. You know, it's like, wow, you turn to the dark side, you're going to raise funding. And it's like, I don't think that's the case. You know, it's like, it's easy to criticize from the stands, and it's easy to look at what someone else is doing and to think, if it doesn't line up with my worldview, then that person has, you know, quote unquote, turned to the dark side. And so I think that the whole thing that I've tried to do throughout my professional career is keep an open mind to things and to ask, am I being dogmatic in my thinking? Is there actually a way for me to use this to grow my business? And frankly, to be adherent to my own moral compass of like, I want to build businesses that help other people and that provide me with a great living and that provide value to customers and that allow me to have an amazing lifestyle that I aspire to. So if you're providing for your family and you're making good money and you're helping other people or other businesses, whether you're bootstrapped or whether you've self-funded or whether you've raised $100,000 from an accelerator or whether you've raised $500,000 from, you know, seed investors or whether you've venture funded, you know, something I haven't done and will probably never do, but whether you've done those things, it's like, isn't that the goal? Isn't that really the goal? Like, should we go back to first principles and say, what are really the mission, vision, and values of quote unquote bootstrapping? Because it's not to say I've never raised money. Because if I build a business, but I work 90 hour weeks and I get divorced and I never see my kids, but I bootstrapped, have I done the right thing? Or is really the goal that like we value our personal time and our family and our own kind of compass to not have a boss and all that stuff? And so that's where I think, you know, certain words become synonymous with being bad. I think some people think venture funding is, some people think just funding period is, some people think doing anything except, you know, sitting and writing code in a basement, and some people think marketing, literally. I've had developers tell me, I liked your book except for all the stuff about marketing because I think that's just scammy, you know? And it's like, you should be more open-minded than that. And I think if you want to achieve goals that are abnormal or that are outside of the normal range of just, you know, of working 9 to 5 for someone else, which is totally fine. But if you want to do something other than that, then we need to be flexible. And to me, it's a growth mindset thing, right? I don't know if you've ever listened to the book Mindset, but it talks about growth mindset versus fixed mindset. And the folks who say, you know, anything that doesn't agree with my current mindset, you know, is bad or toxic or binary, but we see it in politics today, right? That's not good. So anyways, apologize for the long voicemail, but it is something I've certainly been thinking about, and I appreciated your guys' conversation about MicroConf, and always a fan of the show. Keep it up.
So, Dave, I thought two interesting points Rob had there. One, I mean, just sort of a clarification, I think, about Tiny Seed, and that, interestingly, I think they didn't really know what they were going to be getting when they opened up applications. And at this point, I think I know they're done reviewing the applications and are kind of picking the companies they're going to be backing. And yeah, probably ended up with different applicant pool than they maybe originally planned on, or maybe they had no idea what they were going to get. I don't envy the decision they had to make of choosing a handful or a dozen companies out of, you know, 900 or something that I heard they got. And it'll be really interesting to follow along with those companies that were selected to see, you know, what they're like and what kind of trajectory they're on, and, you know, through the years, what kind of growth they can achieve with this funding, and, you know, does it let people quit their jobs or to let these companies grow faster than they would have otherwise. So, yeah, I mean, from the first part, I think of his voicemail, a good clarification that there's a lot of stuff they consider, and that really anybody can and should apply probably when they open up for the next round, and that they consider a lot of different things, not just MRR, right?
Yeah. And in fact, that was my misinterpretation from the conversation I had with Einar. So I'm glad that he spent the time to clarify that and understand that there's many dozens of signals that go into this decision here, that it's not just a one and done kind of number, or there's like a magic filter that says, if you're not making this, we're cutting you off, you know, nothing like that. So that's good. That's good to hear. And I appreciate the fact that he took that time to clarify. The other thing that I thought was kind of interesting, and I threw this out on Twitter today, was this very binary thinking that it seems has been present in the MicroConf community for a long time. And I'm not saying everybody is subject to this, and I'm not saying I'm not subject to this, because I do this as well. I think this, you know, spreads all the way from personal politics into our business lives as well, where we just sort of put this false dichotomy of it's either X or it's Y. You know, you're either Republican or you're Democrat. You know, you're with us or you're against us. And, you know, you're either funded or you're evil. Or no, well, actually, that's not even the right dichotomy, right? You're either bootstrapping or you're evil. That's what it is. I tried to make it dramatic and I failed.
Freudian slip kind of there or something, right?
Yeah. But I mean, that whole set of thinking is already toxic. And I'm really glad that he took the time to point that out as well, because you can't boil things down to an either or. I mean, our lizard brains may be programming us to do that, but at the same time, I mean, we've got to have more nuanced, more thoughtful discussions around this and say, hey, you know, this works if, or these things are good when, or don't do this if you see that kind of stuff, as opposed to, oh, you took funding, fucking sell out.
Yeah. I mean, the way I look at it is like, it's ironic, maybe not coincidental, that like the champions of bootstrapping, the guy, you know, Jason Fried and DHH, get up and say, you know, we took $6 million from Jeff Bezos. They are the bootstrapping guys, right? They are the, we're going to run Basecamp until we die, and it's super profitable and all this kind of stuff. And they took funding. So like all these folks, myself included, who think that bootstrapping a company is a really, really great way to go, don't say that you will never take funding, or that funding is evil, or that if you take funding that you're a sellout or can't make it on your own or whatever, because those guys did. And obviously it's working out really, really damn well for them, because they are an ultra profitable long-term company. Yeah. I mean, I think that we get these things in our head to say like, yeah, binary, it's this or it's that. I think, you know, it's funny, Dave, I asked this question of, I think, Rob and Patrick Collison from Stripe. They did like a Q&A at MicroConf 3 years ago now, the only one I've been to in Vegas. I said, when would you take funding, or do you think it ever is like a good time for bootstrappers? And both of them, I mean, Patrick Collison, obviously they've taken a bunch of money and it's proven out well to them. And I think both of them said, in the right situation, it's absolutely the right thing to do. In a lot of situations, it's not, you know? And I think we saw like a couple of tweets of that from Jason Cohen. He's basically like, bootstrapping is usually the best way to go, but in some situations, it's not, you know?
Yeah. And I still think that compared to, and I'm going to throw this all the way back to like 1990 something, where it was the dot-com boom and everybody that had the word, you know, internet or e-something, e-bags, you know, if they had this stuff in their prospectus and they went and did a pitch deck to investors, they were just throwing money at them hand over fist without really understanding, was this a viable market? Is this a real business model? Can you actually acquire customers? Can you do it profitably? Can you do it sustainably? All of the things that as a bootstrapper, you have no choice but to figure out up front, you know, I like the bootstrapping model for doing that customer product market fit validation. I think that there's a lot of good reasons to do that, but I think there's also a point at which that can hold you back. You know, mm-hmm. If you look at WP Engine, they were going after the mid-market WordPress hosting, managed WordPress hosting segment. And it was very clear that Jason needed to act fast. He had market validation. He had an idea that clearly resonated, but he wasn't going to be able to build it fast enough on his own and scale it quick enough to take advantage of his first mover advantage in the market. So he bootstrapped enough of it to feel confident about it and then move it up to funded. And, you know, WP Engine is I don't even know what their market cap is right now, but it's big. And they just took a $250 million investment from some set of limited partners to be able to continue to fund their growth. And, you know, they're huge in Austin, and that's great. And that's exactly the kind of nuance that we need to embrace in our community and say, it's good under these circumstances. It doesn't work under these other ones. Find out what's right for you.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think for me, if you can get product market fit, get the product out the door, get some people using it, and if you think you have a rocket ship, then taking funding, giving up the percentage of equity so that you can grow faster is one of the few instances for me personally that it makes a lot of sense, you know, because the upside is way better than the downside in that case, you know. But to take funding when you don't have a product and don't have customers and go like the real VC route to just put a pitch deck together and try to get into Y Combinator or something is, one, we're not talking about the same thing as like, you know, tiny seed and indie VC and earnest capital. They are not the same thing as VC. So I think that's another thing is like Y Combinator and these, you know, new models are absolutely not the same thing. Should not be applied to the same type of business in the same place that they're at in their life cycle and stuff like that. So yeah, I mean, it's all where you are personally, where your business is, your appetite for risk, and what your ambitions are, I think. So anyways, a long story short, I think, you know, thanks to Rob for, you know, sending in the voicemail and clarifying a few things and kind of offering some more perspective around those two things. And for everyone else, send us a voicemail because we love them. We love to kind of get a chance to talk about what we talked about in previous episodes more and continue the discussion, because I think that's what everyone enjoys, is just like continuing the discussion that we're all having on Twitter, you know, on the podcast or in, you know, our forums and stuff on the podcast. And stuff like leaving us a voicemail is not hard. Just create your phone, record it, send it to us in Dropbox, and we'll include it in the next episode. It's not hard, right?
Not hard at all. And if you feel like that's too hard, just send us an email. Everybody can type.
Yep.
We're open to multiple forms of technology. If you want to send it via carrier pigeon, I'm sure we can figure out a way to receive it. But
we can figure it out, man. Yep.
Yes. Yes. So moving on to this week.
So I think in lieu of kind of having updates about our businesses, we'll do that next week. But this week we're going to be talking about tailwinds and headwinds in business kind of in general, right, Dave?
Yeah. So I found an article that was on a Practical E-commerce, a site that I subscribe to, and they were talking about how their particular business, where they were sort of a fitness business, and how these various tailwinds had kind of accelerated them in ways that they didn't appreciate at the time. So one of them, they were talking about the creation of the internet and the fact that they were able to get online earlier, then massive broadband adoption, which allowed them to reach a broader audience, and then finally the CrossFit craze that also allowed them to promote a specific thing to a specific audience at that time. That gave them all these hidden advantages to their business. So while the article itself was very e-commerce specific and really not necessarily applicable to bootstrap online businesses, in general, I thought that talking about what tailwinds and conversely what headwinds we're seeing now have either given us, you know, things that are making our businesses easier or things that are making our businesses more difficult. So I was sort of looking back across the time when I started with the WordPress plugins and realized one of the very first tailwinds that I had access to was the fact that there were not many people that were trying to monetize things in WordPress.org. So the plugin field was very open. The competition was very low. The bar was set low in terms of if you provided customer support, that was unbelievable. If you provided documentation, that was unbelievable. If you had a website that made it easy to buy this thing, that was unbelievable. There weren't really easy ways to necessarily do license support for, you know, selling your plugin and things like that. So if you could pull all that stuff together in 2011, 2012, suddenly you are in a place where there are very few people standing there, and you look better than everybody else because you're one of the few that's doing that. And at the time I was sort of like, yeah, wow, this is pretty cool. I mean, I can make a business of this. But now looking back and the people that are trying to do the same thing 7 years later, it's getting considerably harder because the bar has come up implicitly during that time. So that was an implicit tailwind that I got back in those days because there was lower competition in the .org repository. So
yeah. I think that we have a couple of these we'll group under like being an early mover in a space. And I think that's really like the genesis of a lot of the article that this guy talked about is like these tailwinds just from being in a market or in a space or in a channel early on when it's got like that parabolic kind of growth. And yeah, absolutely. WordPress.org, whatever, five, at least 10 years ago, it definitely seems like the place. For me, a little bit getting into podcasting when I did 4 years ago, when we started this podcast, when I started Podcast Motor, was really the early days. It's like dog years, you know, like it's forever ago in the podcasting space. And I think we've enjoyed just some benefit from just staying around so long. And now, you know, to be able to say we've been doing this for 4 years really gives us a lot of credibility, not to mention things like SEO and all that kind of stuff that just compounds over time. And then I think the other one of kind of being an early mover is I wasn't around in 2010, Dave, when you got into it, but just kind of being in the bootstrapping space, the microconfy kind of crowd for so long gives you a lot of like name recognition and connections and network, right?
It does. And I was sort of looking at, you know, when we were making the list of headwinds here and what advantages that I've received over that time and ones that are harder that if you come in now, like it's a little bit intimidating. I've heard this from first time attendees at MicroConf that they're like, well, I've seen all these people. Maybe they're in Founder Cafe. Maybe they're on Twitter. Maybe I've listened to talks that they've given in other places, but I'm kind of intimidated because they're all here and they're all talking about all this stuff. And I don't have all these stories to talk about. Well, back in 2011, during the first MicroConf, I had no stories. 2012, I had a very weak story. 2013, my story was slightly more interesting, but was still very poor compared to so many other people that were there. I mean, that's 3 years of just grinding away to finally get something to talk about. But during that time, you're meeting these people, you're talking to these people, you're forming the basis of a friendship through this business connection here. And since, you know, I'm looking back this last year, that the biggest thing that I got out of MicroConf was really just reconnecting with all of my old friends, having these conversations about where's your business at, because we've been talking about it for 7 years. So this is definitely a tailwind by sort of jumping in early to this community and making all these relationships. It's going to take people 4 or 5 years to kind of get a group of people that are like, hey, would you like to come join a mastermind? Or, hey, how's your business been going? It's been, you know, 12 minutes since I last heard you. It's that doesn't happen instantly. You have to invest some time, invest some energy. And if you're an introvert, you know, you've got to invest double the energy because it's a little harder, right? And MicroConf forces you to be somewhat extroverted while you're there. And it's very exhausting for introverts. As an ambivert, I kind of feel that, but you know, at least I can still tap into my extrovert side and get through it. But at the end, I'm just like, oh, okay, I'm ready. I'm exhausted now. I'm done.
Yeah.
But all of, you know, that is a tailwind now because I have a bunch of relationships that I can leverage, and that networking allows me to go say, oh yeah, you know, you want to do content marketing? Hey, talk to my friend Brian Castle over here on audience ops. Or, you know, when I started Big Snow Tiny Conf, it was because I had met Brian and Brad. You know, those things compound over time. So that is definitely an advantage that I didn't expect to get out of this, but ended up picking up over time. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think the next kind of meta topic of the tailwinds that we've both seen is I guess we would call it like longer runway, right, is the meta topic. And I think it can be either the new funding models like Tiny Seed and Earnest and IndieVC and all these, even like the debt instruments that are out there now for SaaS to allow people to continue to grow their businesses on a different trajectory than they could otherwise maybe. But Dave, the one you mentioned is having a consulting job, or me having Podcast Motor, product I service, I don't spend a ton of time on, and provides, you know, paying the bills at least, for me to focus my mental energy and time and stuff on growing something like Castos, right?
Yeah. And I think this is still a tailwind now for a lot of people. Like, there's multiple different kinds of ways you can take advantage of this tailwind. So when we were talking about all this stuff in 2010, 2011, you basically had one other model. Well, I would say that there's two other models out there. One was to go work for megacorp or maybe small megacorp and, you know, work 30 years, do your gold watch retirement, which even then we didn't believe because it had already been proven quite well that these companies really didn't give a crap about you and you wouldn't last there 3 years, let alone 30. But there was that option. And then the other option was to do a startup, but that was like the whole venture-backed, it's all or nothing, you're risking your entire life, your mortgage, your energy, your health, everything. That was really the two models that you had. And it wasn't until we took, you know, DHH and Jason Fried and those guys more seriously to say, hey, look, you know, we can actually do this. And there are examples of this that are going on out there. And then you could start, instead of like trying to give up all your life and just say, all right, I'm going to do this bootstrap business and get these customers, that you could work it from a side project and get it a little bit further, a la MailChimp, right? Where they took originally as a side project and then built it into a business. And then now it's a multi-million dollar a year SaaS. The narrative wasn't that common. And it wasn't until 2010, 2011, we started having these conversations and saying, hey, you know, you could bootstrap this to a side project using a consulting job. You can bootstrap this by buying this other business and using that income stream to help you fund it. You can bootstrap it by going to Tiny Seed or IndieVC or Earnest Capital Now and getting their application and then taking the $120K and being able to work on this for a year. So those longer runways are now available to us in so many different models that are common. There are people who've done them. There's a clear path to success for those that do it. They can talk about what the struggles are and what the successes are that come from that. So it's not something you have to navigate blindly or by yourself anymore, which is what happened back in 2010. So
Yeah. I'm going to pile on here and kind of stress that a productized service is one of the best competitive advantages you can have if you want to get into SaaS. Because, I mean, I have been able to pour almost all of the money back into Castos for a long time because I haven't needed it to pay the bills and for us to live and buy groceries and stuff. If you don't have that and you're going to bootstrap a SaaS from scratch in 2019 and you need the money that it makes, you are going to be up against a big hill. And if you can say, I am making my money over here in this thing that is relatively passive and I have to kind of manage a little bit and it's a handful of hours a week and the rest of my time and energy and the money that it makes can go back into the business. That is, it's funding. It's like a form of funding that is really attainable, doesn't really cost that much other than your time and energy to set it up initially, and is something that I think everyone should really think about. And I would be happy to talk to anybody that wants to talk about it and see how they can make it work for themselves. But it is absolutely wonderful as an asset to grow another really potentially big business and like something that's more scalable like SaaS. But a productized service, even now, Dave, I think that like if I just wanted to pay the bills, that's exactly and only what I would do because it is a fantastic lifestyle business and it lets you do anything you want, including, you know, going after SaaS, which is really hard and takes a long time. So don't play it down. Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be productized service either. The plugins are helping me fund recapture when I need to do development pushes where I can't afford that straight up on the MRR. So there's lots of ways to do that. Yeah. This is part of the stair stepping method, right?
Yep.
So the next thing that I would say is a major tailwind that I've certainly had a lot of experience with is all of the different tech that exists that has really come up in the last decade that makes it that much easier to create a SaaS. So you've got stuff like Stripe, you've got Twilio, you've got SendGrid and Postmark and AWS. All of these things, when put together, make it super easy to build a bigger business more quickly without you having to put together every last little goddamn thing. I mean, like Stripe was the biggest one. I mean, that was the first thing I thought when I went through this exercise here. Stripe literally changed the bootstrapping community because it was Stripe this and Stripe that. And, you know, they had APIs and they talked to developers and they were like, how do you want to use this? What is it you needed to do? They were very developer friendly. And so, you know, everybody's putting it into various kind of libraries, PHP, Ruby, a straight up JavaScript library. So everybody could integrate with this thing quickly and easily. And if you can integrate with it, now all of a sudden you can take credit card payments in the middle of your app. And then all kinds of other businesses appeared on top of that. This is when Barometrics came about, and First Officer, and Price Intelligently, and all of these other things that built their business on top of this. So all of these tech companies have given us an implicit advantage, whereas if you tried to do this 10 years ago all by yourself, you had PayPal and their API, both of which sucked.
Authorize.net, which whatever, I don't know.
And yeah, I mean, then you had even worse options than PayPal.
Yeah.
Authorize.net was like the next one down. Like, you didn't want to go there unless you were desperate, because whatever PayPal had just didn't work for you. So yeah, I mean, there's lots of things that have made it so much easier to set up and accept payments in a business. And that has been a major headwind, a tailwind to businesses that are building online.
Ironically, this will also be a headwind, though. So
stay tuned.
There's two sides to this coin. Yeah.
Yes.
For me, and for you too, Dave, I think remote work has been a huge one, both that I can do this from wherever I want, right? We live in France now. It's amazing. But also we can work with really talented people who live anywhere that in a lot of cases are less expensive than, you know, living in big cities where developers in particular are expensive. And I think the other part of that maybe isn't talked about as much is the benefit for those people too. Like, the benefit for us as the business owner is great that we can live where we want and we can work with really talented people that live wherever they want. Maybe they're less expensive than, you know, people for surely like in San Francisco or whatever. But for those folks too, they get access to really good jobs in places where those kind of really good high paying jobs don't exist with as much frequency, you know? And I'm thinking about, like, on an extreme basis, somewhere like, you know, the Philippines, where these people, if they're making $1,000 a month, they are rich, you know? And we are able to provide that to a lot of folks, and we're very happy and they're very happy. So I think it's definitely like the win-win of remote work has been something that a lot of, like, people in kind of both sides of the relationship have really benefited from.
Yeah. Yeah. I would totally agree on that one. And it has been a very beneficial wealth transfer, you know, coming from North America, one of the richest countries in the world. Not that North America is a country, it's a continent, but it, you know, just want to make it clear for the geography pedants out there. Yes, I understand what North America is, but, when you're trying to hire the best and the brightest, that you suddenly are not bound by local restrictions or being able to put a classified ad in a newspaper and hope that somebody comes in and shows up and is of the right fit and that you can afford them and so on and so forth. So yes, that has been a major advantage as well. The next one has to do with the early adoption of a paid acquisition channel. And specifically, the ones I'm thinking of are Google AdWords and Facebook ads. There was definitely a golden period when, if you were in early on these things, you were getting clicks for dirt cheap. Those clicks were easy to acquire. The keywords were very clear to target. You had a very high ROI. And the response rates on these things, like the conversion rates, were much higher than they are today. So if you figured out a channel early on, you dialed it in, and you just basically were starting to throw money into that, you turned it into a massive machine. And this is what I watched Rob do on HitTail. And I've seen Ruben Gomez do this on BidSketch, where they were just pouring money into these things and acquiring customers cheaply and quickly, getting great, great results. Unfortunately, this has also turned into a headwind, and I'll just dive right into that now, is that if you come in later into these channels and try to repeat the success of people who've done this previously, the costs have gone up and the conversion rates have gone down. Plus, now you have like the whole Facebook Cambridge Analytica scandal, and they've changed their models, and you can't get the same audience information that you used to. You can't do certain kinds of targeting, and this is all for good reasons. But unfortunately, this means that the effectiveness of this paid channel has gone down. So that's like an implicit headwind that has come later on. But if you adopted it early, you kind of got in and you got this magic thing, but it didn't last forever.
You know, I wonder, this is kind of a tangent with this one. I wonder if this is a bit of like survivorship bias, where we only hear the good stories of people that did this 5 years ago.
And oh, probably. I mean, I try to be aware of all my biases. Yes, that's probably there.
And that, like, the same stuff that worked before isn't working now, but these channels are definitely still working. And I'll say, without giving away our special sauce, we are making paid acquisition working for Castos for a $19 a month SaaS product. So it definitely can still happen. And so I think that, like, just because it's not easy doesn't mean it's still not an option. And you might have to work harder and look around at these options a little differently than the stories we heard, you know, from Ruben and Rob and all these people that did it just by throwing up shitty Facebook ads 5 years ago. Sorry, guys. They probably sucked. Everything has to be really good and really on point. So it's like, it's still a viable option. It's not the tailwind that it was before. It was just like really easy to do. But I think it's not, it's a headwind. It's not a total showstopper at this point, you know?
Yeah. Headwind doesn't mean you can't do it. Headwind just means it's less efficient than it used to be.
So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I would agree with that. I would agree. All right. So the last tailwind I want to raise here is sort of goes hand in hand with like the tech adoption where this advantage didn't previously exist. One thing that I saw when I was doing WordPress plugins was that in terms of marketing tactics, the WordPress community was definitely not at the forefront of trying to adopt certain marketing tactics. So, and Rob saw the same thing. He's mentioned this in his talks about Hittail and how he did Drip. He was looking for a lot of his tactics in the internet marketing community. So this is the very gray area group in many regards, and sometimes just straight up black hat techniques. But they were the ones where gave Rob the inspiration for doing things like split testing and email marketing. And these were all tactics that they had honed using their scammy, scary products that they were trying to push on the Warrior Forum. But when he brought those tactics forward and said, hey, let's do this in SaaS, everybody was like, oh, okay. Wow, that's pretty cool. For those that looked into it and they're like, oh, I see how that can work. For those that didn't, you know, they were like, oh, you adopted this thing from a scammy source over here, so you must be a scammer too. But that same adoption wasn't like universal. So when I was going to microconfs, I was listening to these things and all these SaaS founders were talking about, oh, well, let's do email marketing. Oh, let's do split testing. Let's do this. Let's do that. I was over in the WordPress space and going, well, nobody over here is really doing email marketing at all. Like, I don't see anybody trying to collect email addresses and send a 5-day autoresponder course about trying to educate the benefits of your product and then try to pitch them on it. So I did those things and it turned into an amazingly successful outcome. That's the kind of stuff that if you are in a space, you're in a particular niche, maybe it's not WordPress, maybe it's something else. If you bring a tactic there that is successful somewhere else, but is unknown there, that becomes an implicit tailwind in that niche until it becomes more common and more well-known and everybody starts adopting it. And then it's less of a tailwind and more of a headwind at that point. But I definitely saw that in WordPress and would say that that was an unexpressed advantage at the time.
Yeah, no, I like it. And I think that the tough thing here is realizing what these are in the moment, because it's easy for us to look back, you know, hindsight's 2020. It's like looking at the stock market and saying, of course, in 2007, it was going to tank. But in 2006, it was really hard to say that. So I think it's tough to get out of the day-to-day and out of our own minds and our own comfort zone to kind of get at a higher level of view and say, what am I missing people in adjacent areas are doing that I can, you know, learn from and implement my own business. I think the people and the place I find this the most is the guys at Drift in the Seeking Wisdom podcast. I don't know if you listen to it, Dave. They are forever talking about getting out of the SaaS world to learn about how to do SaaS better. So I think if you're kind of not doing it, that's a really cool place to like listen to that podcast to get some inspiration about like how can we look to other industries and maybe like the old school copywriters and stuff to figure out like what are we missing today that can really make a difference.
Yeah, it's always good to get out of your bubble and get a better perspective on things by looking at how somebody else is doing it. And either that can tell you, oh, I can improve on this, or, oh, I've never heard of that, or, wow, ours is working so much better than that. Maybe you can even offer something into the conversation that they aren't aware of. So it's just a positive, beneficial exchange all around.
Yep. So now that we're done talking about all how it's all roses because everything is so easy for us, we can talk about how some things are getting really hard, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we've already mentioned a couple of these that have turned into headwinds here. But the one that we specifically already started with was the fact that while we had a lot of technologies like Stripe and Twilio and SendGrid and Postmark and AWS that made things really easy for a while, now, well, because it's lowered the barrier to entry, it's easier to start. But there's more competition, and now it's much harder to be successful. There's just so much more, I don't want to call it noise, but so much more energy in the space. You're competing for attention, and there's so many Me Too products out there that it's hard for you to stand out in that crowded space unless you've got, you know, a compelling story, a viable niche that you can focus on, something like that. So that makes this more difficult to get traction. Right?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that the competition that all of us are seeing is definitely higher. I think it validates the market and the business model and stuff like that. And a lot of people are getting savvy to it, saying like, you know, the margins around SaaS and the recurring revenue nature of the business is just amazing. And so people that are really, really smart business people are getting into the space and saying, we can make a go for this because our next one, the barrier for entry to getting into this is so much lower than it was 10 years ago. So you have things like Stripe, which we mentioned before, AWS, like Bullet Train from Andrew Culver, right? So you're not a developer. You want to kind of buy your way into the first 6 weeks of development of a SaaS. You buy Bullet Train and you have Stripe and you have users and you have API and you have all this stuff that every SaaS needs. Then you can go hire a developer to kind of finish out the edges of what makes your SaaS unique. You don't have to start from scratch. All these things make it easier to start, you can just, you know, spin up an EC2 instance. Like, that's amazing. Like 10 years ago or whatever, 15 years ago, you know, buy the server for like $20,000 or whatever, and it sits in the closet. If the power goes out, you're screwed and all this kind of stuff. That like, it is so easy to start all of this stuff. Now, Stripe Atlas is another like beautiful example of like anyone in the world can start a business with like a few clicks of a button, which is super powerful. But anyone else in the world can be your competitor in like 20 minutes, you know?
And you've got the same thing with like Zapier. So you don't even need to code anymore. You just need to connect a bunch of existing services out there and make a business out of it. Yeah. I mean, that's how Ken got started with Mastermind Jam. Back then, Zapier was very much a fringe thing to be taken advantage of. Nowadays, I'd say it's much more mainstream. I mean, not everybody knows about it, and you still have to have some technical skills to use Zapier. You got to think about, you know, event-driven programming basically, but you don't have to write code to do it. And that's still pretty powerful. But again, because that lower barrier to entry is there, anybody could do it. So if you have that idea, somebody else might have that idea. And if they didn't think of that idea, as soon as they see you with your idea, they can come copy you with that idea.
Yep.
Way more easily than they could have before. And that is definitely a headwind.
Yep. So, you know, Dave, I think this is a whole podcast episode we'll talk about soon, but our good friend Patrick Campbell from PriceIntelligently/ProfitWell talks a lot about price sensitivity of customers changing not in a good way these days. So things like higher customer acquisition costs, lower willingness to pay for consumers, and freemium being something that is expected from most consumers, even in like a B2B space. I think this is definitely, probably a result of the ease of competition and the increase in competition is that, you know, the pricing trend is going towards, you know, zero basically over a long period of time. And so people who just say, go charge more, might be up against like a bunch of competition from people who are out there saying, you know, we can make this part free and give it away as like lead gen for something else. That just totally screws your business if that's the thing that you're planning on paying for. So I think just kind of price sensitivity and the whole pricing dynamic is, again, a headwind. I think there's always a way and a space to go up market and go for a more enterprise-y move. But I think that if you're not thinking about adding value as like your kind of metric for pricing, then you can find yourself in a bad spot when it comes to price and customer willingness to pay and things like that and kind of the economics of your business. Yeah.
And I saw this exact thing when we brought Recapture from Magento over to Shopify, where it was a very different market, very different expectations of what kind of a customer you were serving, how big was their store. Shopify has lowered the barrier to entry. By lowering the barrier to entry, they've also lowered the willingness to pay. And so you get lots of stores that are very aspirational, and they come in and they look at your solution and they're like, yeah, I'm not going to pay $49 a month for abandoned carts. There's 284 other competitors over here. At least half of them are free.
Yep.
They may not have the capabilities, the deliverability of Recapture or whatever, but you know, you're just one of 284 possible data points out there to them. So that's why the Shopify app store is getting so crowded, because there's lots of Me Too's coming in there and doing that. You know, there's still places to stand out. I don't want to make it sound like it's totally bleak and Recapture screwed, because it's not. I've actually had three great months in a row, but that's the kind of headwind that you're seeing. You know, if I had jumped into the app store in, see, I'm trying to think, when did Shopify start the app store? I want to say it was like 2007. That sounds a little early. Let's say it was 3 or 4 years ago when they launched the app store, because I think the 2007 number is bullshit, and I'm going to have to look this up afterwards. But when Shopify first did the app store, if you were one of the early movers in the app store, guess what? You got tons and tons of installs because you were one of the only ones there. That's a tailwind. Now there are, you know, 284 competitors that all say abandoned cart. Now it's a headwind. So you got to find something that differentiates you. You got to find a different way to get in there. And they are definitely not willing to pay the same prices that they were in Magento, because the pricing at Shopify is very different than the pricing of Magento. They're looking at a build out cost, you know, of anywhere from $20,000 to $40,000 on an individual server to develop it and get the store up and running. And then they're looking at a variety of other things. If they're hosted on Magento Enterprise, they're paying like $400 a month to get the damn thing run and managed as its own thing. So come in and say, I want to charge $40. They're like, oh yeah, sure, whatever. And you do that with Shopify, their bottom price is like $29 a month.
Yeah.
And so if you're charging more than $29 a month, those entry stores look at you and they're like, I can't pay that. I'm not going to pay that, because you've got a price anchoring problem.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just very different. Lower willingness to pay on lower solutions. And God forbid you ever go to someplace like Squarespace or Wix, where they're selling apps for $4 a month. I mean, I honestly do not know how people can make a viable business model out of that. But there are people trying, and God bless them all.
Well, and this is, I mean, I think this is exactly kind of like the next point we're talking about, is funded competitors, huge competitors getting into smaller markets, or even down market, I guess, talking about Wix and Squarespaces, you know, these big, huge content management systems, for example, getting into selling to direct consumers for $5 a month or $20 a year or whatever. And really savvy businesses behind these, you know, organizations with a ton of money and resources and stuff like that. And if you're trying to go up against those guys thinking, oh, I can just, you know, carve out my end of the lower market, you're going to get screwed. Like, it's just not an option. So I think it's just more people being in the space. It's a lot of them go up market, and that's great, because that's typically not a place a lot of bootstrappers want to go, is like enterprise. But a lot of people are coming in and just smashing the lower market too, just pure manpower.
Yep. Yeah. Or just pure resources, where you can go bottom of the barrel pricing because you know you're going to attract tens of thousands of customers and suddenly make it viable from that perspective. But yeah, that's a whole different approach, and definitely a headwind these days.
Yep.
So we'd like to hear from you at this point. Again, voicemail, email, carrier pigeon, doesn't really matter to us, but are there headwinds or tailwinds that you think were super important that we totally ignored? or you think we should discuss more, let us know. podcast@roguestartups.com. And as usual, our ask is, if this podcast was valuable to you, share it with someone you think would also benefit from it too. Until next week.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Rogue Startups. If you haven't already, head over to iTunes and leave a rating and review for the show. For show notes from each episode and a few extra resources to help you along your journey, head over to roguestartups.com to learn more.